From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
There's no way that you can resist that. I was hooked. I mean, I was addicted from that moment on. I mainlined Shakespeare.
A successful book editor tells us how getting hooked on Shakespeare allowed him to reinvent himself as a Shakespeare teacher. Also, we'll explore the important contributions that amateurs have made to astronomy and paleontology as we celebrate the amateur in this hour. And we'll find out what happens when amateur songwriters pay to have their poems set to music. The results are song poems.
The great thing about song poems is these people are really putting the effort out to express themselves. And I think it's really brave to attempt to express yourself when the world isn't really giving you much encouragement back.
Herman Gulab was a successful book editor. He'd worked with many famous writers, including Donald Barthelme, Bill Moyers, and Willie Morris. Just as his publishing career was winding down in 1995, Herman Gulab experienced two life-changing events, events that resulted in a personal transformation. As he describes it, Gulab became an old man made mad by love of Shakespeare. Now Gulab's written a book called Me and Shakespeare, Adventures with a Bard. Gulab told Steve Paulson about the first event that caused his addiction to Shakespeare, a 1995 Broadway production of Hamlet, starring Ralph Fiennes.
This came into New York, a much heralded production. Ray was in London, and there was a big build-up, so I went to see it. And it was a, what you call a galvanizing production of Hamlet. Fiennes was electrifying. I mean, he played Prince Hamlet like a man possessed. He was dark, violent, sardonic. In fact, he seemed more like one of the brothers Karamazov than the Prince of Denmark. The whole production had this kind of pulsing immediacy to it, an energy, which is what a Shakespeare production has to have. So I left the theater in sort of a semi-hypnotic state and realized that this was the first time I'd ever seen Hamlet on stage. I'd seen the movie Hamlet, some of which are quite good, but never on stage. Also, I realized that I could count on the fingers of both hands, if that, the number of Shakespeare's plays I'd actually seen staged. Again, the movies, but not the stage.
So you were not exactly crazy about Shakespeare up to this point.
Well, you know, it's not that I wasn't crazy about him. I was smugly assumed that I knew a lot about the immortal bard and his works. Heck, I was an English major in college. I was an editor, a very civilized, cultivated guy, right, literate person. I was in college. I was an English major, yes, but of course it was only a semester. This was Texas A&M, a military college, right? And so there's much we neglected. Titus Andronicus, Pericles, you know, Cymbeline, Troilus and Cressida, one of the great Shakespeare plays. Love's Labour is Lost, another fantastic Shakespeare plays. All's Well That Ends Well, Measure for Measure, Need I On? But again, those were not in my repertoire. So I had basically what Oscar Levant, the late wit and pianist, called a smattering of ignorance. And that humbled me, frankly. Mm-hmm. It was dismaying.
So what did you do then? You saw this wonderful production. You realized that Shakespeare mattered, that he spoke to you in a way that you had never thought before.
Well, that was the beginning, but that wasn't the clincher. It was only, you know, the prologue to it. There was two experiences, both of them involving Shakespeare performance, which is the way it should be, because Shakespeare meant for us to see and hear these plays. Man. The primary impact is supposed to be emotional, because this is drama. In the old days, they used to say, let's go here. Shakespeare. If they wanted to go at the Globe, let's go here, Macbeth, at the Globe. But that second catalytic event is what I'd call that catalytic experience. And now what I consider now probably one of the crucial guides to appreciating Shakespeare, what he's all about, to loving Shakespeare, becoming obsessed with Shakespeare, was a 11-part television series called Playing Shakespeare, which is a series of master classes or workshops conducted by John Barton, this eminent director of the Royal Shakespeare Company, from members of the company. Times Ian McKellen, Patrick Stewart, David Suchet, Ben Kingsley, Judy Dench.
So all these people were on tape talking about how to perform Shakespeare.
Yeah, they sat around this bare soundstage, you know, dressed in slacks, jeans, and so forth, holding these scripts in their hand. And they would perform a segment from one of Shakespeare's plays, and then John Barton would discuss it with them, you know, maybe suggesting a different approach. And they would incorporate it and do it again. Then Barton would turn to the camera and, you know, address us directly, trying to clarify how Shakespeare's text, the verse, works. How he uses antithesis, ambiguity, paradox, irony, what the essence of Shakespeare. And that was when I really began to learn what Shakespeare was all about. I mean, I watched these tapes. I bought them. A friend of mine had recommended to me the very day that I left AA. Talk about perfect timing, because I'd been raving about Ralph's Hamlet. She said, if you think that's good, you ought to get these playing Shakespeare tapes. So I bought all 11 of them at a cost that put a dent in my IRA. It was worth it, because this is what really changed my life.
But that sounds like the kind of thing that a specialist would gravitate to.
No, not a specialist. No. That's the mistaken thinking that way, because this is the humanist approach to Shakespeare. It's the real approach, because it's Shakespeare as theater. If you watch this, you would be so enthralled, I guarantee you. You would go out tomorrow and buy all 11 tapes. I promise you that. It's exciting to watch this. It's like behind-the-scenes stuff, because they're witty. You're caught up in the sheer joy these people have in getting to the essence of Shakespeare. There's no way that you can resist that. I was hooked. I mean, I was addicted from that moment on. I mean, I mainlined Shakespeare, and that was the crucial experience for me, the experience that did it.
It may sound surprising to give a whole program over to irony, but Shakespeare uses it over and over. But today we're not very good at irony. Most of us use it rarely, if at all. I suppose the best people at handling irony in Shakespeare that I've ever come across has been New York drama students, and particularly black students. And that's because irony is part of their natural idiom. They use it daily, but we don't. Sardonic humor, maybe. Sending up, certainly. But irony, not very often.
And you say that this changed your life, this experience.
Yeah. Just one thing was very eerie. I watch them so often, I still do, that I think they know me, that I'm part of the company, that if I walk down the street, David Suchet was like, Herm, how you doing? You know, did you watch me yesterday? Yeah, sure, David. You know, you were good. It's really that kind of intimacy and, as I say, immediacy from that. It's alive. It's electric, that stuff. And it goes to show you also, you don't need to dress up a bunch of actors in costumes and throw up a lot of scenery on a stage to understand, to love Shakespeare, to get the maximum, the emotional dramatic impact from. In fact, it can be a hindrance. Watching a Shakespeare play with heavy scenery and loaded with costumes and a lot of props is a detriment. Shakespeare's got to be freed from that stuff. Got to be moved organically, fluidly. The best production of Shakespeare you can see is one that has this energy, constant movement, electricity.
So what did you learn about Shakespeare watching these tapes that you'd never understood before?
One of the things I learned from it is that Shakespeare was one of the master ironists. Everything in Shakespeare is keyed around irony and antithesis and ambiguity. Once you learn those essentials, you really begin to put all of Shakespeare in focus. We're not talking about just metaphor, the richness of the language. We're talking about those techniques, which are basically dramatic techniques. If you don't understand Shakespeare as a dramatist, you will never, ever understand Shakespeare, never appreciate it. Forget about understanding it. You'll never thrill to it, because it has to be essentially a thrill. And that's what you get. Playing Shakespeare means playing Shakespeare. Having a lot of fun with Shakespeare, acting Shakespeare, bringing Shakespeare alive on a stage, which is the way he intended it.
Give me an example of irony.
When Brutus is trying to convince himself that he should assassinate Caesar, he has this one soliloquy, and one point in which he says, the abuse of greatness is when it disjoins remorse from power. And to speak truth of Caesar, I have not known when his affections swayed more than his reason. The irony there is that Brutus himself is a guy who's letting his reason overpower his affection as he's trying to rationalize his meaning, his way into the assassination. That's a bald example of Shakespearean irony. I'm sounding a little pedantic here, ain't I?
Well, I know you teach Shakespeare gone from student to teacher.
Yeah, well, frankly, that's the great thrill of all this is finding that new vocation, a new life. To say gratifying is sounding a little smarmy, but it is. In fact, I've been doing this for 5 years.
You teach these lifelong classes.
Yeah, I teach at this little Catholic college in New Jersey, Caldwell College, at the Center for Continuing Education, at this thing they call Lifelong Learning Institute for seniors 50 and better, as they say in the catalog. And I started doing this in the fall of 97. I've been doing it ever since. And I told my wife, just a few months ago, I said, you know, if I had done nothing else but this with my life, I would have considered a life well spent. Forget editing all those books, being in publishing, all those power drinks and lunch. And this is what I find the richest experience I've had.
Why?
Because one, you're doing something you really, I'm an amateur, because I don't get paid for this. I'm an amateur in the essential meaning of the word, which is someone who does something because he loves it not for pay. And I'm an enthusiast, and the pure sense of the word, somebody who's possessed by God. And we know who that God is. For me, it's Shakespeare. Also, these are people, the class, I love these people. They're my peers. They bring to Shakespeare an experience of life. I mean, they've raised families, and they've served their country in the armed forces, and they've survived three wars and a depression, right? They've been to weddings and funerals, bar mitzvahs, baptisms. They've been hired and fired and pensioned. So they know what Hamlet means when he talks about the whips and scorns of time, or what Hector means in one of my favorite Shakespeare plays, Troilus and Cressida, which I didn't read till I was 66, alas. And he looks down at the gates of Troy and says, time, that old common arbitrator, will one day end it. And what the King of Navarre and Love's Labor is Lost, another play I came to very late. Wonderful. If you haven't read it, go read it right now. It's wonderful. Funny, touching, savage. What he means when he says he vows he's going to outwit what he calls cormorant, devouring time. And in Hamlet, you know this line from Ophelia, probably the most poignant word spoken in Shakespeare. We know what we are, but know not what we may be. Time and change, those are themes that haunt all of Shakespeare's work. It sort of gives you the goose pimples. It gives you the shivers.
Herman Golub is the author of Me and Shakespeare, Adventures with the Bard. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
There was this king sitting in his garden all alone when his brother in his ear put a little bit of poison, stole his brother's crown and his money and his widow. But the dead king walked and got his son and said, now listen, kid, I've been killed and it's your duty to take revenge on Claudius. You kill him quick and clean and tell the nation what a fraud he is. The kid said, right, I'll do it, but I'll have to play it crafty so that nobody suspects me. I'll pretend that I am daft. So to all except Horatio, he counts him as a friend. Hamlet, that's the kid, he pretends he's round the bend because he isn't ready for obligatory killing. He tries to make his uncle think he's tuppence off the shilling, takes the rise out of Polonius, treats poor Ophelia vile, tells Rosencrantz and Guildenstern that Denmark's blooded bile, till a group of travelling actors like the ones who stand before arrive to do a special one-night gig in Elsinore. Oh, Hamlet, Hamlet, very balmy. Hamlet, Hamlet, loves his mommy. Hamlet, Hamlet, hesitating, wonders if the ghosts are cheating, that is why he's waiting.
That's John Wesley Harding with Hamlet. Coming up, we'll do some stargazing with Timothy Ferris. He'll tell us how amateurs contribute to astronomy. And we'll dig up the dirt on the world's largest Tyrannosaurus Rex fossil.
Then as we were excavating her, we got joking, well, is this really a girl dinosaur or is it a boy named Sue like the Johnny Cash song?
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Timothy Ferris has been described as the best popular science writer in the English language today. He's the author of nearly a dozen books, including one called Seeing in the Dark, How Backyard Stargazers Are Probing Deep Space and Guarding Earth from Interplanetary Peril. In this book, Ferris reminisces about his lifelong love affair with stargazing, which began when he got his first telescope at the age of 12, back in 1956. Timothy Ferris told Anne Strainchamps that he still loves watching the skies.
The sight of Mars still thrills me as much as it did those many decades ago. I think perhaps it's the realization that we live on a planet and that it's possible to look out and see other planets that represent sort of alternate forms of reality and start to find your place in the wider scheme of things. I think there are a lot of motives for stargazing, and on one level it's just like taking a walk in the woods, you're just seeing nature on a large scale. And on another level, of course, there's all the wonder of science and how science works and the incredible ingenuity of this unprecedentedly successful method of finding out how the world works.
We tend to think of astronomy as something that's very technical, very professional. So it's surprising to read in your book how many amateurs have really played an important role in the development of modern astronomy. Who were some of them?
Well, of course, astronomy was largely amateurs for most of its history, as all sciences pretty much used to start as amateur pursuits. And so you had great amateur astronomers like William Herschel, who discovered the planet Uranus and mapped the heavens and was really a remarkable observer by anyone's standards. And his sister Caroline was also a very accomplished stargazer. In the 20th century, astronomy became particularly professionalized because a few big telescopes were built, mostly in California. And if you had access to those telescopes, you were pretty much guaranteed to make discoveries. But since there were many more astronomers that wanted to use them than there was time available, the people who got use of those telescopes really moved out into the forefront, and the amateurs were left far behind. But now there's been a technological revolution that has put observing power back in the hands of anyone who wants to spend a little time and money putting it together, so that there are thousands of amateur astronomers now who have backyard telescopes, the light gathering power of which exceeds that of the famous Palomar telescope of 40 or 50 years ago.
Ordinary telescopes people can have in their backyards can exceed the power of Mount Palomar?
It's amazing, isn't it? The reason is, it's really three things. First, a guy named John Dobson here in San Francisco got interested in astronomy. He was living in a monastery at the time, had no money, and was obliged to figure out really cheap ways of making large telescopes. So he invented what's known today as the Dobsonian telescope. He never patented it or made any money on it, but there are tens of thousands of them now. And Dobsonians are just big, simple telescopes that make it possible for the same investment of time and money that used to give you a little telescope with which you could just see planets and bright nearby objects to have a telescope that can see galaxies hundreds of millions of light years away. Now, if you put a digital camera, another development, one of these so-called CCD cameras, on one of these middle-sized telescopes and you hook it up to a computer, and then you have the internet connecting you with other amateurs all around the world, you have a lot of light gathering power. I can, with my own little amateur telescope, I can take images in 30 seconds with a CCD camera that exceed what all but the largest telescopes in the world were capable of doing just 20 years ago.
So how far can you see just with a fairly ordinary telescope that any of us might buy and put in our backyard?
Well, if you look at quasars, which is sort of cheating because they're these very bright nuclei of distant galaxies, but just putting your eye up to the eyepiece of a backyard telescope, if you know where to look, you can see quasars 3 billion light years away. That's light that's more than half the age of the Earth and the Sun. The quasar will look, however, just like a star, just a point of light. To see galaxies, your best views will be of galaxies ranging up to a few tens of millions of light years away. And that's still light that's, you know, a lot older than the human species.
Wow. That's such a long way from thinking it's kind of nifty to see the Big Dipper.
It is. It's, you know, it may be all part of the same continuum, but I always recommend to people who want to get into stargazing that start really simply. Just take a star chart, there's some of them in the back of my book, and a flashlight, and you want to make the flashlight red light so it doesn't dazzle your eye, and you can do that by just wrapping a piece of red plastic around it or painting the lens with nail polish. And just go out with those two things, a star chart and a red flashlight, and a child is a good adjunct to that expedition, and start finding your way around in the sky and learning the constellations. And if you have a pair of binoculars, have a look along the Milky Way and you can see more. And then if you find that you like it and you want to go further, a good way to proceed is to go to a meeting of the local amateur astronomy club. They often have these, typically on the dark of the moon, they'll have star parties and the public is welcome. And you can look through other people's telescopes. And that's a good way to get an idea whether you might want to get a telescope yourself. And if so, you know, what size and how much do you want to spend on it?
Tell me about some of the backyard stargazers you met for this particular book, some of the amateur astronomers who've really changed the face of astronomy.
Well, we have some remarkably acute visual observers who have pushed and extended the limits of what it was thought people could see through telescopes. There used to be a tendency in amateur astronomy to just, because the telescopes were so small, to just look at big, bright, pretty things, so that typically the hobby consisted of looking at the same few dozen objects primarily. Now that amateurs have bigger telescopes, there's a lot more you can see, and there have been some aggressive amateur astronomers who've sort of tested the limits. One of them is Barbara Wilson in Texas, who has made a specialty of just checking out what you can see. When Barbara sees a new Hubble Space Telescope photo, her first instinct is to find out where that thing is in the sky, look at it through her own telescope, and see how much of it she can see. And the answer, astonishingly often, is a lot more than one might have thought. Stephen James O'Meara in Hawaii similarly has taken visual astronomy to new heights. Stephen was the first person to see with his eye Halley's Comet as it was incoming on its recent return to Earth a few years back. He did that using a professional telescope up high on Mauna Kea in Hawaii and breathing bottled oxygen to enhance his night vision. Steve's also the guy who discovered the so-called spokes on the rings of Saturn. He did that as a young man using an old refracting telescope at Harvard Observatory, which was just as an amateur. He was given a key to the observatory because his self-taught knowledge of astronomy was so good. And he kept seeing these spokes and even correctly charted their rotation rate. At the time, no one believed they were real. They were thought, if anything, to be an optical illusion. So no one would publish his findings. The Voyager spacecraft then got to Saturn, and if you read in the books and the internet nowadays, they say, well, Voyager discovered the spokes, but it was actually Steve O'Meara with a Harvard telescope.
But it makes it sound as though astronomy isn't actually all that hard, and yet I know it's a very technical science.
Astronomy is like music. There are all different ways to approach it. You can do astronomy in a very rigorous mathematical way, and there's some great astronomers who do that. You can be more conceptual or artistic about it. There are a lot of ways to approach it. And, of course, if you're doing amateur astronomy, you can do whatever you damn well please. You don't have to publish in the journals. You don't have to report to any committee of academics. And that's one of the strengths of amateur astronomy. There are a lot of areas of research now where what's required is more people and more telescopes than the professionals can muster. NASA has a new project enlisting amateur astronomers to search for planets of other stars. It turns out that a lot of amateurs have the necessary equipment. All that's required is the patience to monitor the brightness of a certain number of stars night after night for a long period of time, see if you might catch a planet, an undiscovered planet, moving between you and that star. Turns out that there are amateurs willing to go through the long process of this research in hopes of what would be an amazing discovery. It's quite possible we will soon see the first discovery of a planet by an amateur astronomer since William Herschel back in the 17th century.
Hmm. Aren't amateurs also taking part in the big SETI project, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence?
Yes, the SETI receivers on these big radio telescopes generate a lot more data than it is realistic to purchase computers to process. They just pour out data. So someone had the bright idea a few years back of offering to the public at large the opportunity to have their own computers during idle moments help reduce these data. So if you go to the SETI website and download this little program, and I've used it myself, it's a nice clean program, it's not a burden or anything. When you're not using your computer, it will quietly sit there and run what are called fast Fourier transforms on these SETI data and then send the processed results back. And over the years, so many people have become involved in this project that taken together, the SETI network is the most powerful supercomputer ever seen on Earth.
Timothy Ferris is the author of Seeing in the Dark, How Backyard Stargazers Are Probing Deep Space and Guarding Earth from Interplanetary Peril. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. Peter Larson is a professional paleontologist. He and his team at the Black Hills Institute uncovered Sioux, the world's largest and most complete Tyrannosaurus rex skeleton in the Hell Creek Badlands of South Dakota in August of 1990. And it was actually an amateur paleontologist named Susan Hendrickson who discovered the first bone fragments. Peter Larson is the co-author of a book called Rex Appeal, The Amazing Story of Sioux, the Dinosaur That Changed Science, the Law, and My Life. Larson told Steve Paulson about August 12, 1990, the day he first saw Sioux.
Well, the first thing I saw was Susan Hendrickson came walking up, and she had two pieces of bone in her hand, and they looked like chunks of honeycomb. And I picked one up, and I looked at it, and it just clicked that this was none other than Tyrannosaurus rex bones. They came from a vertebra, and T. rex bones have a texture like bird bones because, of course, they're very closely related. They had a one-way breathing system just like birds of today. And so, needless to say, I got very, very excited and ran over to the site with her and saw these just fragments of bones dripping out of the hill and cross-section about 8 feet across, about 7 foot up in elevation on the side of the cliff of these wonderful bones coming out of the hillside.
Now, you saw 8 feet of bones or so, but that's still far from a complete T-Rex skeleton. But somehow you had a feeling that it was all there under the ground.
Well, I guess one learns to trust one's senses and one's just feelings, if you will. Been collecting fossils for a long time, since I was four, and that's 46 years ago. So you get kind of a feeling for things. I don't know if it's what you're observing so much as that feeling inside, but I'm sure all of that kind of puts itself together. And I just knew at that moment that this was going to be the most important fossil that I'd ever dug on.
You knew that? Just the moment that you laid eyes on this, even before you started digging, you knew this was going to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
I just, you know, had that just plain certainty about it. I knew that the skull was going to be there. I knew it was going to be a complete or relatively complete skeleton. Of course, by looking at the bones on the surface, I knew the preservation was just marvelous.
Now, of course, discovery is one thing, but actually getting the bones out of the ground without everything crumbling into dust is quite a trick, I would think. How did you do this?
Well, it's a very complex and rather tedious thing. Of course, you have to dig down. We had permission to, you know, use hand tools, but not to use anything, any mechanical tools. So we went up about 25 feet above the specimen on the cliff face, and I was figuring approximate dimensions of what the fossil would be like, and we started cutting down. By the time we got above the fossil surface itself, we were 25 feet into the wall, almost 30 feet down and 30 feet laterally as well. And because it was going to be such a large excavation, I wanted to get all that overburden off at first, because if you leave bones exposed on the bottom and then you have to go back up again and dig, you can have real problems. But it took us almost 3 weeks to get the bones out of the ground. But that's just the beginning. It's about 25,000 hours of work to prepare a T-Rex skeleton. It's just almost an unbelievable amount of labor that has to go into it.
Why does it take so long to do that?
Well, you can't do these things very quickly. Of course, it's been laying around for 65 million years. It's had literally several thousand feet of sediment above it at one time. That crushes the bones. The bones are still in place, but they're broken into little tiny fragments. And so we have to apply a lot of glue as we collect and a lot of glue as we are removing that matrix. And there's minerals that have sort of attached themselves to the bones over time with the groundwater percolating through the sediments. And so we have to very carefully remove those. You can do it quickly, but you destroy that surface detail that is so important in looking at the muscle attachments and trying to develop soft tissue anatomy and physiology and trying to see what was going on with those bones and looking for things like pathologies, which tell us basically little snapshots in the life of that animal and tell us about disease and injury and what happened after as a result of that.
You said that you were applying glue as you were extracting the bones. What were you gluing anything onto?
Well, we're actually gluing the fragments of bones together again because, again, the sediment has crushed them into little tiny fragments. They're still in place, still where they belong, but there's a little tiny hairline fractures that you can't always even see as you're digging. So as you uncover each square inch of that bone, we put on mostly cyanoacrylate, super glues basically, and another thing called polyvinyl acetate, which is another plastic that helps to make sure that we get glue in every fracture to hold that specimen together.
Now, you named the skeleton Sioux, and obviously you think it was female. What made you determine the gender?
Well, the name came about, of course, in honor of Susan Hendrickson, that wonderful amateur paleontologist who was volunteering her time with us and who brought those first fragments of bones for us to look at. But then as we were excavating her, we got joking, well, you know, is this really a girl dinosaur? Is it a boy named Sue, like the Johnny Cash song? That got me thinking, well, you know, have we ever looked at, is there a way to actually determine the sex of a dinosaur? And it turns out that through about 10 years of research that I think that there are some really, really good ways that help us determine at least the sex of these meat-eating dinosaurs called theropods. And it turns out that Sue really is a female. And there are two morphotypes, or two types of skeletons, a more robust form like Sue and a more gracile, a more lightly built form like that second T-Rex that we excavated called Stan after Stan Sakrison. And the big, mean, nasty ones were female.
How big do you figure Sue was when she was roaming the earth?
Sue was approximately 40 feet in length, about maybe as much as 41 feet in length when you add up the total tail vertebrae. And she could look through a second floor window without any problems at all.
Would she have looked like one of those dinosaurs in Jurassic Park?
She very much would resemble that T-Rex that we saw in the Jurassic Park movies. In fact, some of the original measurements of Sue were used in creation of that beast in that first Jurassic Park movie, that first T-Rex.
Do you have any clues as to what killed Sue?
We have actually some pretty good evidence. When we look at her skeleton, we look at the way she was found, the bone behind her left eye has been torn away and broken and sort of laying almost dangling, if you think of it in that way. The bone behind that, the squamosal, has actually punctures in that bone, not healed punctures. This is something that happened either as she died, when she died, or after death. But even more telling is the back of that left lower jaw has been pulled out of its socket, pulled to the side, where the front is still in line underneath the front of the jaw. So I think literally she had the left side of her face torn off by the bite of another T-Rex.
Wow. What makes you think it was another T-Rex?
Well, it's the only animal big enough to do that, and the puncture wounds match with T-Rex teeth.
So there's real drama that you can read into these ancient bones.
I think that's one of the most exciting thing about the, to me anyway, of what I do is I get sort of little images that these create little, almost little movies in my mind, which maybe I'm a little nuts, but it really spurs my imagination to think, what does this mean? What is this? Here's this broken bone in the leg. You know, she had a broken fibula. What does that mean? What could that possibly mean to a bipedal animal like myself? In fact, I did a little test. It was rather inadvertent, but I broke my leg and I found out that you cannot move your muscles when you have a broken bone in a limb. You can move them maybe very, very slightly, but you have no control over them and absolutely no strength. This animal was helpless, and that bone healed. The only way she survived that broken leg was the same way that I survived my broken leg. She was cared for by her mate that brought her food while she convalesced.
So you actually know that T-Rexes had mates and they lived together and they looked out for one another?
Well, I think that things like that broken leg point to that. Now, I guess the fun thing about paleontology is some of the questions and some of the answers are always going to be a little bit fuzzy because, you know, we can't bring them back to life. But I think there's enough evidence there to support a hypothesis that shows that. I think family life was a very important thing in the lives of these theropods, these meat-eating dinosaurs, because we know that with Sue, we found parts of a smaller male, a juvenile T-Rex whose skull was only about 18 inches long. Remember, Sue's skull is 5 feet long. And a baby T-Rex whose skull was only about 10 inches long. And that's not the only instance where we have multiple burials of T-Rex. There was also specimens exhumed by the Los Angeles County Museum in the 60s where there were two individuals buried together. And now in Montana, a place that Keith Rigby is working over by Fort Peck, Montana, they have found multiple individuals, at least two and maybe three or more individuals in that same site again. So here we have repeated instances where you have more than one individual buried at once. I think that's really convincing argument for some sort of a family life or some sort of an interaction, a gregarious activity by these animals.
You and your team at the Black Hills Institute have uncovered 7 T-Rexes, which is just an amazing number. How do you account for your success?
Amateur paleontologists, they're the ones who call us up and say, come out and look at what we found. And I think I might have a T-Rex. Or
this is a, I think I got a Triceratops skeleton coming out of the ground because I can see a horn. And we go out and go to those people and see what they've got and help them. Or, you know, when they realize in the case of a big fossil, it's just way beyond their capabilities, then we're able to work with them, or because of them, we're able to excavate skeletons. And, you know, to communicate with people and to keep all those channels open and to give people credit when they make a discovery like this wonderful discovery Susan Hendrickson made and the one that Stan Sakrisson made with the second most complete T-Rex. That, in the end, is what I guess people who love fossils are the happiest with, and that's some recognition for the contributions that they've made to the science.
Peter Larson is the co-author of Rex Appeal, the amazing story of Sue, the dinosaur that changed science, the law, and my life. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
I thought he'd never leave.
Well, I'm a little dinosaur.
Where's that little dinosaur?
He must have.
Please don't go away. Oh, no.
If you have comments or questions about our program, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. Coming up, the song sharking industry. It's where companies lure amateur songwriters to pay money to have their poems set to music. These songs could become big hits, but they never do. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Some troublesome place. Burmese land is like monkey land. Listen, I'll tell you so.
The thing about song poems that is the most striking quality to me is it's obviously modeled after actual music. It's actually in the style of rock or pop. So it's got something that is extremely familiar about it. At the very same time, due to the circumstances of the lyrics and the way that these things are slapped together, make it one of the strangest, most unfamiliar things that you've ever heard in your life. You've heard nothing like it, ever.
It's a clip from a documentary film called Off the Charts, the song poem story. Song poems start with small ads in the back of magazines. These ads invite people to send in their poems. The ads say that your poems may earn money for you. The reality is that the poems will only earn money for the companies running the ads. That's because you have to pay to have your poems set to music. The results are called song poems. Jamie Meltzer is the director of the documentary film Off the Charts, and he says these budding songwriters can be anyone.
These are just ordinary people. And there are many reasons why they might do it. It might just be a hobby. It might be something that they're looking to get into the music business. Of course, this isn't a way to get into the music business, but they don't know that. And they're generally people really on the margins who are just sort of expressing, you know, something that they feel they have to express. And that's kind of the beauty of it. It's sort of a window into, you know, what an ordinary person thinks should be a song or should be a poem. And then you combine that with this company that's just out to make a buck. And the results are pretty interesting.
Putting together your film, you went to meet a lot of people on both sides of that equation, I guess. Can you describe for me one of the people who writes the poem, somebody you met?
Well, there's this guy in Iowa. His name's Gary Forney, and he's been a poet ever since he was a teenager. And he started doing song poems. He saw an ad in the back of a tabloid magazine and sent in a poem that he had lying around. And he really liked what he got back. He doesn't play instruments, and until recently he didn't sing. So it was a way of him for him to turn poetry into songs. And I think he really responded to the fact that with a song, you're communicating with more people, and it's a much easier, sort of an easier way to get your message out, whereas a poem is a more solitary activity. A song can be shared.
So what does he write about?
So he writes about, he says, you know, the things that concern him, his family, what's going on around him in Iowa. But he'll also mix stuff up, and he has a couple crazy songs about, like he says, he'll write about ordinary things like his dog or something, but he'll say, you know, I might write about aliens stole my dog or something just to make it interesting to other people.
Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you hear my song? Hey, Mr. Spaceman, bring back my dog.
Isn't he the one in your film who was singing with his son?
Yeah, he and his son. His son is sort of almost the opposite of Gary. He's really into, you know, heavy metal, hard rock, and Gary's more of a folksy kind of guy. But they get together and sort of work that out and play more on Gary's side of things. Yeah, they decide that instead of doing song poems, instead of sending their lyrics out, they're going to do it themselves. So they take their songs to a local, I guess it's a sort of folk fair in Iowa, and present it to the audience there.
This little song's called Chicken Insurrection. This here's a little ditty about some chickens and me, and how I got in trouble the day they all got free. I took a job out in the country, they paid me in mass whiskey. Just keep an eye upon some chickens didn't seem too hard to me. Well, there's chickens in the cornfield, in fact, chickens everywhere. Chickens plotting secrets, and chickens hatching plans. Of chickens driving Cadillacs to Washington, D.C. A chicken insurrection.
Seems to me they maybe should have practiced a little more before their performance.
The way I had to approach it was really not to judge anyone in the film, because I just wanted to approach everyone as if basically that the product didn't matter. And the great thing about song poems is these people are really, you know, putting the effort out to express themselves. And that's what Gary's doing as well. And I think it's really brave to attempt to express yourself when the world isn't really giving you much encouragement back. And that's sort of the position he found himself in, and sort of had to, believe in himself. And I think he does. And I think any artist has to believe in what they're doing, maybe even to the point of delusion, which may be the point that Gary might be at, some people might say.
Your film includes a tribute to a song poem composer who's considered one of the greats, the late Rod Keith. What was it about Rod Keith that was so terrific?
Well, there was a couple things that made Rod great and made him stand out above the rest of the people doing this. I think he really put a lot of himself into the songs. I mean, and some of the other people do that as well, where you just, you know, you can approach these things as sort of a joke. You know, a lot of the lyrics are very weird or funny. But I think Rod really just said, okay, well, I'm going to approach this as sort of sincerely as possible and give it my all and put my heart into it. And then the other thing is he was just a master musician and could play a ton of different instruments and could kind of do it all. So it was almost like he was doing the whole thing himself in an age where people just didn't do that. And he played an instrument, was one of the earliest people playing a Chamberlain, which is kind of like an analog keyboard with loops on it. And he played this instrument, also called the Mellotron, later in a way that no one did. I mean, it was usually used as a backup or a filler instrument, like playing like a symphony or trumpet sound. But Rod would use this thing, you know, as the entire band, and it just gives a sound that you've never heard really anything like it.
Natives have been dancing, they jump in Tahiti. They learned the newbie, it's got them going wild. Janana shaking, their beads and bones rattling. Witch doctor head under native child.
Did he work for one of these companies, or did he run one of them? Did he actually solicit lyrics from people?
No, he wasn't on that end. He worked for a couple different companies. I think the main one was Preview Records and MSR Records, which were the biggest ones in the 60s and 70s. And he was just their staff composer and musician, and he also sang on a lot of the songs. So he wasn't involved at all with the customers, I don't think.
It's interesting, isn't it, that with that much talent, why didn't he just write the songs himself and make a career out of this?
Well, apparently, what I talked to some of his friends, and some of them are in the film, and what they said was that, you know, he really wanted to be a classical composer, which is about as far as you can get from song poem stuff. So it's unfortunate, but he never, he just sort of got locked into doing this song poem stuff, and it was a way for him to make money, and he was never able to express what was truly in his musical heart, I guess.
There's another of your, the people you talk about in the film, his name was Singletary?
Yeah, his first name is pronounced Shalar Juan Singletary.
Tell me about him.
He's, I think, probably one of the best lyricists in the film. He wrote a song called Nonviolent Taekwondo Troopers and another one called
Wait a minute. Nonviolent Taekwondo Troopers?
Yeah, and the interesting thing is actually in the song it doesn't refer to anything in the title. It has nothing to do with nonviolent Taekwondo Troopers at all. It has to do with thanking God for Kung Fu Bicycles and Priscilla Presley. So I don't know if I can actually explain what that song's about, but it's a great song.
Come and live a spirit of Jesus Christ. Thank Jehovah for Kung Fu Bicycles and Priscilla Presley.
Do they tend to write about certain things, certain subjects that they take up time and again?
Well, it's interesting, because the one interesting thing about song poems is it's not the stuff that you would hear on everyday pop radio. There's been a couple of albums, Odes to Presidents. There was a series of albums about President Jimmy Carter in the 70s, and mostly disco songs about Jimmy Carter. There was tributes to Elvis. That there's, you know, topical issues that people are responding to. And like if someone, you know, like when Elvis died, the song poem business just exploded, and it was one of the biggest times. And Princess Di, and, you know, I think after September 11th, there's been a lot of songs about that. So it's really just a way for ordinary people to get something off their back and to express themselves.
When somebody sends in lyrics, do they say, I hear this as a disco tune, I hear this as a country tune?
Well, what happens in the process is, you know, you send in your lyric and they say, hey, this is a great lyric, we want to put this to music. And then they send you a little checkoff sheet, basically, that says, okay, I want the tempo on this to be, you know, fast, medium, or slow. I want it to be a rock song, a country song, or a ballad. And you just sort of check it off. And I'm not sure how much, they probably pay a little bit of attention to that. But since they're dealing with people who don't know a lot about music, I think the musicians sort of take it upon themselves to compose the music to the lyrics, you know, as they see fit.
Do you have any favorites after all of the song poems you've listened to?
You know, there's different qualities about song poems that I sort of respond to. There are the funnier songs, like Jimmy Carter Says Yes is a, you know, a nice, sincere, but very funny song because it's a song about Jimmy Carter, but they sort of set it to a disco beat, and it's a little bit odd, and it definitely works. It's something that sticks in your head for days.
Can our government be competent? Jimmy Carter says yes. Jimmy Carter says yes. Can our government be honest? Jimmy Carter says yes. Jimmy Carter says yes. Can our government be decent and open? As the 39th president, he has spoken yes. Jimmy Carter says yes.
And then there's Rod's stuff, which just, you know, I think is as good as the work of any musician I've heard. I mean, his stuff really stands out, and I listen to it all the time. There's a song called The Flitting Firefly, which uses it's sort of the metaphor for the firefly and the fragility of life or something. And it's a really nice lyric, and Rod does the Mellotron stuff to it, and it's just really touching and beautiful.
Did you ever try to watch a firefly as it flickers in the dark? If you ever tried to catch it or to find its flickering spark, or tried to find out where it goes by following its light, its flash is gone, you lost your way and stumbled in the night. And so it is with fleeting loves, they sparkle for a while, but all too soon they lead you on your senses to beguile.
That's The Flitting Firefly by the song poem composer and performer Rod Keith.
Rod Keith is one of the people profiled in Jamie Meltzer's documentary Off the Charts, The Song Poem Story. Turns out we have a few aspiring songwriters here on staff, and they thought it would be a good idea to write some lyrics about, to the best of our knowledge, a theme song of sorts. So they sent their words to Art Kaufman of Magic Key Productions. Art set the words to music and then sang them. Here's the result.
You've got a curious mind, a big appetite for ideas. You'd like to learn about stuff like democracy and tortillas. Let Jim Fleming be your tour guide for this intellectual trip. It's smart, entertaining radio that's eclectic, fun, and hip. To the best of our knowledge, it's like a radio college. You don't have to pay no high price tuition. To the best of our knowledge, you've got to acknowledge that we're your best source of cerebral nutrition. Every hour of the show has its own cool theme, like Islamic fundamentalism and why do we dream. We cover solar powers and psychic phenomena, high energy psychics and the history of Hanukkah. We might spend an hour combing through hair, or we may drape through woods and frolic with bears. Spiritual matters, what happens when we die? How to clean house and why do we lie? It's an audio magazine that's easy on the ears. To the best of our knowledge, it runs the emotional gamut from laughter and through to tears. Yeah!
That's right. That's Art Kaufman of Magic Key Productions with our To the Best of Our Knowledge song poem. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a cassette copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 921B, Amateur Hour. If you have comments or questions about the program, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Ann Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Ira Glass has helped reinvent storytelling on the radio, but he says it took him years to learn how to tell a good radio tale. Next week on To the Best of Our Knowledge, Ira Glass on the art of telling stories. We'll also visit The Moth, the mecca of storytelling in New York City. And why lots of people no longer read adult novels. They say kids' books have better stories. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.